This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Chua Eun Teck. On the night of November 21st last year, a wave of public demonstrations and protests erupted in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, demanding for closer European integration. The sustained civil unrest culminated in the ousting of then-president Viktor Yanukovych. Now that Russia has formally annexed the Crimean Peninsula, what does this mean for Ukraine going forward? Here to help us understand more is Jan Ersten Müller, a visiting senior research fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. He is also the former state secretary of the Royal Danish Foreign Ministry, as well as the adjunct professor at the Singapore Management University and Copenhagen Business School. Welcome to the show, Jan. So, what caused the discontent which led to the initial protests in Kiev?
Well, I think that it is a question about a societal model. Which economic model? Which political system? Ukraine is torn between Russia and Europe, if you look at it through the lenses of history. But it is also clear that Europe has much more to offer Ukraine than Russia. Russia is basically a petroeconomy with almost 90% of Russian exports coming from oil, gas, and minerals, which means that there's very little manufacturing, very little agriculture, very small market in Russia. While Europe, irrespective of the euro crisis, is a much larger economy with a big market, with a big potential, with technology. So looking at it from the eyes of a Ukrainian citizen, you would say that we would much prefer to link up with Europe instead of linking up with Russia. And if you look at the figures, you can actually see why. Because go back to 1990, then the income per capita in Ukraine was more or less the same, maybe slightly lower than in Poland and some of the other Central and Eastern European countries. But over the last 25 years, they have doubled or tripled their income per capita because they joined Europe, because they became member of the European Union, while nothing has happened in Ukraine. So it's very clear that from the perspective of a Ukrainian citizen, Europe is attractive, Russia is not.
Many of us assume Ukraine is a homogeneous country, but that is not the case. How diverse is Ukraine ethnically and culturally?
Well, the figures is that the Russian share, ethnic Russian share of the Ukrainian population varies from region to region, but it may be, let's say, about one-third. When you look at the various polls coming out from Ukraine, it shows that the fact that you are an ethnic Russian and that you speak Russian does not mean that you want to be a part of Russia. According to the polls, and we don't know how accurate they are, half of the ethnic Russians want to be in Ukraine, and the other half wants actually to be in Russia. So if we say that all the Ukrainians want to be in an independent Ukraine, and half of the Russians do the same, we will get to a figure of approximately 70-80% of the population in Ukraine want Ukraine to be independent. If you look at the figures from Crimea, there was actually a referendum in 1991 where the question was asked, do you want to be a part of an independent Ukraine? And 54% of the people living in Crimea at that time answered, yes, that is what we want.
Why is Ukraine so crucial to Russian President Vladimir Putin's plan?
I think the main reason is Russian domestic policies. Russia and Putin is running their own political system. It's based on oligarch. It's based on corruption. It's based on a limited number of persons actually acquiring the large part of the wealth of the nation. And the freedom of speech, freedom of gathering together all these kinds of things. Fundamental freedoms, fundamental rights of freedoms are limited in Russia. So Putin will probably look at it in the sense that if Ukraine is successful in changing its political model away from one which is very similar to the one in Russia and adopting a Western-style political model with fundamental rights of freedom, market economy, a liberal political system, and it proves to be a success with a high growth rate, which is likely, then his survival, his political system, will be in danger. So he is looking at Ukraine as the first line of defense for his own political system in Russia. If Ukraine changes its system, Russia will be next. The Russian population will then ask for changes in Russia. That is, to my mind, the primary reason. There's a secondary reason, and that is geopolitical, foreign policy, security policy. And that is that if Ukraine moves towards the West, and from Putin's point of view, even worse, if it joins NATO, Russia will be, if I may say so, surrounded. Mm-hmm. NATO will have moved farther east. That means that Russia's power, Russia's influence will be limited, will be curbed. And of course, it does not want that. These are the two main reasons.
You said Russians may demand for greater freedom if Ukraine is allowed to flourish. But Putin's approval ratings in Russia are at their highest now. Why do Russians currently support intervention in Ukraine?
First of all, we should not overlook that when the annexation of Crimea took place, there were actually demonstrations in Russia gathering a large number of people, and I don't know how accurate it is that the 50,000 people demonstrated against it. Many of the ordinary Russians, they say, why are we doing that? It costs a lot of money. It's expensive. We would like those money to be used for schools, health, education, improving our standard of living. We don't want them to be channeled into a foreign policy enterprise. That is one point. The second point is that, yes, he's popular now because it demonstrates that he's a strong man, he's in command, he can do things. Many Russians, they of course regret what happened to the Soviet Union. Until 1990, Russia or the Soviet Union was a superpower. Today, Russia is a weak power. So there's a lot of nostalgia in Russia, looking back to the, if I may say so, good old times. And Putin suddenly delivers on that score. He annexes Crimea. He gives Obama and the U.S. a bloody nose. And he says, I don't care what you think. And the Russians say, great. But I'm not sure that they will continue to say so when they are going to foot the bill and going to pay and see the economic consequences. Then they may actually have second thoughts.
Going past popular support, do you think Russia have a legitimate or historical claim to Crimea?
No, I don't think so. I know that is how the Russians look at it. Mm-hmm. And I know that if you look at history, the foundation of the Russian culture goes actually back to Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. But that does not warrant or legitimate the steps that have been taken. And that does not mean that you have the right to move into another country. So I don't think that there is such a claim. And the fact that an overwhelming part of the Ukrainian in 1991 voted for an independent Ukraine actually makes a Russian claim very, very, very weak. If I give you the figure from my recollection, and I'm not absolutely sure that it is the exact figure, about 80% of the people living in Ukraine in 1991 voted for independence. So I don't think that there is such a claim. And you should also note that for Crimea, at least, Putin has very clearly said and evoked strategic interest. But strategic interest does not legitimate that you annex part of another country. Strategic interest does not legitimate that you say this country should be ours, as there are some who say about Ukraine. So there is no such claim.
I have been speaking to Jan Ersten Müller. He is the senior visiting research fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. We are talking about the Ukrainian crisis. Coming up, we'll ask him more about what the annexation of Crimea means for international law. BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Chua Antek. Jan Ersten Müller, a senior visiting research fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, is here to help us understand the political crisis in Ukraine. Coming back to the Crimean referendum, close to 99% of the Crimean population voted for annexation or to leave Ukraine and join Russia. Why is this referendum not being recognized by the United States and the European Union?
For a variety of reasons. I don't know what happened during the referendum. I was not there. But the problem is that nobody else was there. The wish for having observers was rejected. So no one actually knows how serious, how honest the referendum was. No one knows how strong a pressure there was on the people how to vote. But we know one thing, and that is that the Crimean Tatars, who actually own Crimea, if anybody does, they advocated not to vote. And it is unlikely that the Ukrainians living in Crimea, and they constitute about 30% of the people living there, did vote. So I think it's extremely unlikely that such a high percentage vote. And even many of the ethnic Russians might not have wished to join Russia, as indeed the referendum in 1991 showed that they did not want to join Russia. And on top of that, how valid is a referendum which is called with 2 weeks' notice and carried through when foreign troops are stationed in your country? If you live in a country which is more or less invaded openly by another country and you are being asked to vote and seeing the soldiers on your way to the ballot box, how honest is such a referendum? I think it's very unlikely that you can say that the result is a fair and legitimate one.
Why does Putin want Crimea?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I think there are several reasons. One of them is geopolitical, and that is that Russia has a naval base in Sebastopol. That is guaranteed by a treaty. But he may have feared that if or when Ukraine moves towards the West, and as I said earlier, if Ukraine joins NATO, then the Russian presence in that naval base will not be so certain anymore. So he may actually fear that Russia's access to the Black Sea and through the Straits of Bosporus to the Mediterranean would be jeopardized. And that's why he acts, because there are Russian interests in the Black Sea, there are Russian interests in the Mediterranean, and the naval base in Sebastopol gives Russia an access to these waters. The second reason may be that by moving into Crimea, he gives a very, very strong signal to Ukraine and to the West. He is saying that I am able to destabilize Ukraine, and I intend to do so if Ukraine moves towards the West and moves towards NATO. Now I take Crimea. Next time, if I wish, I can take some of the eastern part of Ukraine. You should remember when you look at this crisis that it is what can be termed an asymmetrical crisis in the sense that Russia is close to Ukraine. You can move Russian armored division from part of Russia to the border of Ukraine and into Ukraine with very limited efforts. It's easy logistically to do. But if the West wants to assist Ukraine, Western troops need to come from far away, either from Europe or from the United States, which will be a very, very heavy logistical effort, not impossible, but extremely difficult.
Russia recently spent $50 billion hosting the Winter Olympics to reassert itself in the global community. Well, two questions about this. Was it an effective gambit, do you think? And second, did his decision to annex Crimea undo all that goodwill?
Well, I think it's correct to say that Russia hosted the Winter Olympics in Sochi, close to the Black Sea, to reassert itself, to give an image of itself, to tell the world that Russia could do things like that, organize things like that, and that Russia, if I may say so, had joined the international community. And, of course, when then shortly afterwards you annex Crimea, that message is obliterated in the sense that the annexation of Crimea is clearly a violation of three or four treaty commitments entered into by Russia and in flagrant contradiction to what Putin told Western leaders before it actually happened. In 1991, Russia guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity. That was reiterated in 1994 when Ukraine said, okay, we give up our nuclear weapons, but we want in return that Russia, the US, Britain guarantees our territorial integrity. These two treaty commitments are crystal clear, and you cannot run away from them. Then, on top of that, according to newspaper reports, before Putin annexed Crimea, he told the Western leaders, and the Bundeskanzler Merkel from Germany is mentioned as an example, that he would respect Ukraine's territorial integrity. Crimea was a part, and legally speaking, I would say, is still a part of Ukraine. So he broke his words.
Do you think it was a right decision to give up its nuclear weapon after the dissolution of the Soviet Union?
I think it was a right decision. And I think that those who actually signed to guarantee the territorial integrity of Ukraine should respect their words. The problem is, what to do now? Of course, the problem with nuclear weapons is that many countries around the world, Iran, North Korea, probably several others, they will sit down and redo their strategic thinking, and they will say that, look, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. It got a guarantee instead. What was that guarantee worth? Nothing. So the only way to make sure that you will not be invaded by other powers is to possess nuclear weapons. So it, from the perspective of proliferation of nuclear weapons, it is an extremely bad evolution which we have seen here.
Russia is also using self-defense as a reason to act. Putin, in his address to the State Duma, cited NATO's continuous eastward expansion and the US crossing of a symbolic red line for Russia's need to act. So in light of all this, do you think Russia have a legitimate reason to act?
I think that the West behaved unwisely, and I think that the West should not have enlarged NATO with Central and Eastern European countries, as was the case 10, 15 years ago. And I think that the West should have let it be known that Ukraine would not be invited to join NATO. I can understand analytically the Russians' fears and the way that Russia thinks that the West has exploited the vacuum and Russian weakness after 1991. That is, to my mind, clear. It was very bad statecraft from Western leaders that they did that. But that does not warrant, that does not legitimize that you break treaty commitments. The fact that NATO was enlarged was a consequence of Russian weakness. It was not because treaty commitments were broken. So I don't think that Russia can say that its action towards Ukraine is legitimized by the enlargement of NATO, unwisely as it was.
It's very well known that Russia wants to foster close relations with Ukraine, but by annexing Crimea, which has an ethnic Russian majority, Putin is effectively giving up on Ukraine electing a pro-Russian leader in the near future. Is this a strategic blunder on Putin's part?
Yeah, that remains to be seen. We will soon have an election in Ukraine, and we will see how the Ukrainians vote. Who will be elected the president? What is the policies to be adopted? Will it be so that a very large majority of Ukrainians rally around a strong Ukrainian national identity? Or will it be so that they will be influenced by Putin's step? I personally think that he has miscalculated in the sense that he has probably thought that his death would be more welcome in Crimea than it was. The Crimean Tatars are already protesting against the annexation, and that the Russian, ethnic Russian population in eastern Ukraine would voice a much stronger support for Russia, and that has actually not happened. Which means that Putin's problems is now that if he actually wants to move towards Ukraine, it will probably be against a Ukraine not totally united, but a Ukraine more united than it was 5 or 6 months ago. On top of that, you can add that economically, this will be very expensive for Russia. So he may yet suffer a strategic defeat, but you can be sure about one thing. He's thinking very hard about how to avoid that and how to exploit the window of opportunity that has opened for him. It's interesting to see that, according to press reports, Russia is now insisting in its talks with the U.S. that Ukraine should be turned into a federation, a much looser state, which is the first step, of course, of breaking up Ukraine as a nation. And that will probably be the main Russian demand for getting into some kind of agreement. And if it happens, I'm pretty sure that Ukraine will slide towards some kind of dissolution, which will turn it into a strategic victory for Putin. But we have to see what happens. There are many cards on the table.
Ukraine seems to have conceded Crimea to Russia. So would you say Russia have won this round?
You can say that Russia has won round one, yes. But if the international community play the cards correct, it's not sure that Crimea will not get back to Ukraine. There are so many options, so many possibilities. And it was also interesting to note that the former president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, a couple of days ago said that he regretted very much that Crimea had been annexed by Russia. So I'm not sure that the result of round one will continue to be annexation by Russia of Ukraine of Crimea. Yes, in the short run. But let's see what happens.
Putin mentioned the precedent set by Kosovo's secession from Serbia in 2008. What lessons can we draw from history in how the global community should react?
Well, I think the main lesson to draw from this is that the United States is still the most powerful nation in the world. but it is less powerful than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Other nations can challenge the U.S. in areas where the U.S. find it more difficult to intervene. And Ukraine, which is asymmetrical, closer to Russia, farther away from the United States, is such a case. So this is the main lesson to draw, that United States is still there, but the global policeman carries a smaller stick than he used to, and he is more reluctant to use it. And this is actually a very important lesson for small states, so that this is actually a lesson to study, to think what is going to happen.
Do you see any parallels between Crimea and World War II when Nazi Germany annexed Austria and large parts of Poland?
No, I don't. A lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the methods used by Putin are analogous to what Hitler did. Hitler stirred up trouble in Czechoslovakia, in Austria, in Poland, through the German minority there. And then he used that as a pretext for annexing these countries. And Putin is using the same method. But Hitler's policy was a war of conquest, actually to make himself into the supreme warlord of Europe, and maybe even ultimately the world. And I don't think that Putin harbors any ideas about that. He knows very well that Russia is too weak for such a plan.
What about their invasion of Georgia? They seem to have got away with impunity, and it seems like history repeating itself.
Georgia was a complicated affair, and the West and the United States acquiesced in continued Russian presence in two small enclaves of what used to be Georgia. But again, I think that you cannot really draw many parallels between what happened in Georgia and what happened in Crimea. Putin and Russia may have thought, yes, we got away with these two small enclaves in Georgia, but still that does not serve as a blueprint for what happened 6 years later in Crimea. I don't think you can really compare the two.
U.S. President Barack Obama responded with economic sanctions to the annexation. Do you think his response was sufficient or adequate?
No, I don't think it was. But the good question is, what else could he do? No one wants to go to war. But because we work here with an asymmetrical case, Russia and Putin are prepared to run a larger risk than the United States and Obama. And they both know that. So the arrows, if I may say so, in the quiver of Obama is not as many and not as sharp as the ones in the quiver of Putin. What could have been done was at an earlier stage to table good statecraft to prevent it from happening. I mean, it was clear what Russia's policies and intentions were. And the United States and Obama could have contacted Russia at an earlier stage to see whether a diplomatic solution could be found. And if that was not possible, maybe the response could have been sharper.
Having said that, would the economic sanctions in place work, and who will it hurt the most?
We know from experience that economic sanctions rarely work. They will hurt Russia, and they will hurt some of the people close to Putin and some of the people that actually support Putin. But to come back to what I started by saying, Putin is defending his political system by what he is doing in Crimea and Ukraine, and he is ready to pay whatever economic price to do that. So if Russian GDP falls with 1 percentage point or 2 percentage points, I don't think that he will care very much. So economic sanctions will not do the trick, no.
You don't think economic sanctions was part of the reason which brought Iran to the negotiating table?
No, I don't think so. It's correct that we have negotiating now between Iran and a number of other powers, but we haven't seen what they lead to. Negotiations, yes, but negotiations are only useful if they lead to a result, and we don't know whether they will. So I don't think so.
How do you think China would position itself in this conflict?
So far, the Chinese are trying to strike a balance, taking, let's call it, a very neutral stance. They abstained in the Security Council. They abstained, as far as I recollect, in the General Assembly of the United Nations, and they have not really pronounced themselves. They probably can see both opportunities and dangers. They, of course, welcome that the United States is being exposed as all weak. But on the other hand, the Chinese have minorities inside their own country. And if you start to float the idea about the referendums, whether you want to be independent or not, that may not exactly be what the Chinese would like.
What does this mean for Southeast Asia? Would we be affected by this at all?
Well, I think to a limited extent, but the main effect on Southeast Asia is that the United States is still there, but less strong as it used to be. You cannot be sure that they will intervene any longer, as was the case 10 or 20 years ago. So the risk for an indirect stabilization in Southeast Asia by a weaker U.S. presence is probably the most important consequence for Southeast Asia.
How do you see this crisis resolving?
In the short term, Russia will not give up Crimea. You cannot see Russia and Putin annexing Crimea, sending in Russian troops, and then 6 weeks later or 3 months later say, oh, by the way, that was a bad idea. Now we have made a deal with Obama, and we withdraw our troops. It's completely out of the question. He will maintain troops, and he will integrate Crimea in Russia. As I stated earlier, it does not mean that Crimea will not go back to Ukraine, but not in the short term. I find it difficult to see how you can find that diplomatic solution now, and even more so before we know the outcome of the Ukrainian election. This election will be fairly decisive in the sense that it will give an indication of how the Ukrainian population has reacted, and maybe most important, how the ethnic Russians react. If the election shows that Ukraine is more united now than before, of course, the room of maneuver for Putin to destabilize Ukraine will be more limited. And the price, if he intends to do a limited military action or a stronger military action, will be much higher. But if the election shows that a large part of the ethnic Russians start to flirt with the idea of moving towards Russia, Putin will feel encouraged in putting the screws on Ukraine and try to destabilize the country as the Russian ideas for a federation, a Ukrainian federation, clearly shows. So we will have to wait to see the outcome of the election before we can make a reasonably underpinned forecast.
Thank you very much, Jan.
You are very welcome.
I have been speaking to Jan Ersten Müller, a visiting senior research fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, on the political crisis in Ukraine, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.